L.W. Williams, Imperial War Museum, accession number 11542, oblique 4, reel 2.
Mr. Williams, reel 2. So, during those long weeks when you were under siege, as it were, in the ship, can you describe the kind of trials that you had to undergo? The discomforts and so on?
And the question again, now?
Presumably you had to deal with heat and pests, vermin and so on board.
Oh, yes. Well, we've not been able to use the ventilation fans and that for quite a time, only every third day when we used to flash up. We had ventilation trouble, and of course the temperature at that particular time was in the dead heat of the Yangtze, which at times, if you was working down below, was 120 and 130 in the boiler room. And we did have trouble with vermin, rats, and which we tried to make traps and that for. But I think the main catcher of the rats at that particular time was Simon the Cat, because we had Simon the Cat, which was a mascot on board that particular time. And
did the rats do any harm?
They did get to a bit of the food stuff now and again when it was left out, until the fact that when it was taken out of the refrigerator and maybe left overnight, you know, when it was ready for breakfast and things like that. But that was sort of experience, you know, and then the chefs and everything got used to that particular routine. But
What was your state of health on the ship, you and your shipmates?
Very well. We at that particular time we had Lieutenant Fernley, who was the RAF doctor, who'd come on board. But we were well short of medical supplies at that time, because, you know, a lot had been used with the injuries, because we still had one or two on board that had minor injuries at that particular time. But it's during the with so many young seamen and that on board, and to relieve boredom, what we used to do was to organise lectures on machinery and damage control for different sections of the ship at different times, so as to relieve the boredom. And we used to have discussion sessions, you know, to like life ashore and things like that. Because naturally, when you're stuck up in a ship where you've got no ventilation and you're down to, say, less than half rations, it can get a bit exasperating for some younger members of staff.
Who organised the lectures?
Well, the senior engine room ratings, Ian McLash and myself, and also electrical officer, electrical artificer, and Lieutenant Commander Strain, who was electrical officer. The Lieutenant Commander Strain wasn't a permanent member of the ambulance crew. He was taking passage up to Nanking to do repairs to the British Embassy radio set, I understand. So he's only taken passage, and of course he got caught in the action.
What was morale like during the weeks of siege? Did people get depressed?
Not really, I don't think. I think we had, luckily, the majority of the senior staff were people who'd been in for, you know, quite a few years, and were able to console the youngsters and the people that were getting a little bit depressed as regards the time and didn't think they'd be getting out, you know, and they helped out that way. And, of course, for the first few weeks, there was a lot of cleaning up and that to do, and this was organised in pattern, as I said earlier. You know, you started forward and worked through it, so there was a lot of work there to do, to repair stuff, which took a lot off their minds. And there was quite a little bit happening up the river as well, you know, where the junks and that were coming past us and down the river. And that particular time, of course, naturally, they'd invaded the national side then. So there's quite a bit of activity going on.
Did you think that you'd be rescued, or did you think that you might be communist prisoners for a long time?
I thought we'd be communist prisoners for a long time because of the fact that when we were actually beached on Rose Island, when it first actually happened, when the shelling first happened, HMS Black Swan, well, no, sorry, not Black Swan, HMS Consort came down from Nanking to try and come alongside us or just by us, and we were ready with tow ropes to try and for them to try and tow us off Rose Island at that time. Well, while she was doing this, she got very badly hit, and she had quite a few casualties. People died. And so she steamed on down the river. And then HMS Black Swan tried to come up, and she got badly wounded, you know, badly damaged and everything. And then, of course, they sent the HMS London up to try and get us out. And she got very, very badly damaged. So in the end, they cancelled all that and just left us there for, you know, to negotiate with the communist authorities.
How much did you know about these rescue attempts?
Well, we could naturally see the consort because she, you know, was in the same vicinity as us when she came down. But with regard to London, you could... You couldn't see because, I mean, she was just starting to come up the Yangtze then. But we heard through the signal, you know, through Commander Cairns then, what was trying to happen. But, well, not Commander Cairns, Lieutenant Weston, who was still injured, but, you know, took control of the ship then.
Do you remember a plane which came to help?
Oh, yes, very much so. Yes, very much so. That's after we got off Rose Island and we'd moved, I think, approximately 8 to 10 miles up river. And we were anchored there, and we were told that the Sunderland flying boat was going to land with medical supplies and spare crew. There was some spare crew because naturally we were short of crew. They were coming up to come off, and the Sunderland circled round us and then landed a little way off the Amethyst, and they sent the junk with Sub-Lieutenant Monaghan, the gunnery officer, with the junk crew, Chinese junk crew, to the yacht, to the Sunderland. And the doors opened on the Sunderland, and Lieutenant Fernley got out of the Sunderland, hopped into the sampan, and they started unloading some of the medical supplies. And Lieutenant Sub-Lieutenant Monaghan got into the Sunderland to help unload them quicker. And at the same time, as he'd done that, the communists opened fire on the Sunderland. So immediately the pilot closed all doors and took off, leaving Lieutenant Fernley in the junk in the middle of the Yangtze. And Lieutenant Monaghan, who should be on the Amethyst, on the Sunderland, going away. So you can just imagine what Lieutenant Fernley felt. And, of course, he managed to get the Chinese junk crew then to take him to the Amethyst. And, of course, he was being fired on by then, but luckily he didn't get hit.
Was the Sunderland hit?
No, the Sunderland wasn't hit either.
So Fernley must have been an asset.
Oh, yes, because he was a doctor then, and he could, you know, naturally treat people who were... I suppose it's obvious that, you know, in the end, after 3 or 4 months, you know, people started suffering from different aspects of complaints that you do get in the tropics, which he's able to do. But naturally, I mean, they weren't able to unload all the medical supplies that they'd brought. So because you know, the Sunderland just took off. It did come back another day, but didn't land because it was, you know, they'd put more guns on the shore and everything to really protect themselves and also to make us more vulnerable.
What markings did the Sunderland have?
Didn't have any not as far as I know, didn't have any markings on the Sunderland.
Now, can we talk about the escape, and can you take me through the escape? step by step in detail as far as you personally remember it, but starting off with the preparations which you personally had to undertake in the way of dealing with the engines ready for the escape.
Well, 4 hours before our escape bid, I was called for a personal conference with the captain, Lieutenant Commander Cairns, who informed me of his intentions to make a run for that night. I was told to keep strict secrecy, and because by telling me this news, one of the utmost importance was an 8-hour dash at full speed, called for the main engines, auxiliary to be used, had to be in first class order. But why he had to tell me 4 hours before is because, in fact, it always takes on turbines and boilers 4 hours to get the ship ready for full use, and you always report quarter of an hour to the captain that main engines are ready. So it takes 4 hours to flash up the boilers and get the turbines warmed up, ready. So he had to inform me of that. Well, just to tell me and to keep strict secrecy, naturally I had to inform the Stoker Petty officer who was going to be on watch in the ballroom, and Ian McLeshin, who was the chap with me, say that we were going to flash up. Well, I did make the excuse that Commander Cairns was expecting a typhoon, and that we needed to flash up to get ready for the typhoon, which was expected around about 10 o'clock, because he was going to make the escape at 10 o'clock. So that's the thing I told the watchkeepers that were going down the boiler room and down the engine room. And then it 2 hours later, to relieve me of that burden, he called the rest of the engine room staff, that's the senior staff, chief and petty officers, and the seaman chief and petty officers, up to his cabin, and told them that he was going to make the break at 10 o'clock. So it relieved me a little bit of the secrecy I had to keep. So then I could tell the engine room staff and boardroom staff who were on watch at that particular time that we were going to make the break. And then Commander Cairns then ordered that the part of the forecastle, because it was dark by then, had to be disfigured. So they ran up sheeting so as to disfigure the shape of the ship forward and aft. And one thing that we had to be very careful of was the fact that we had a junk alongside us at the time with women on board who used to negotiate. If the Commander Cairns had negotiations with the communists ashore, they used to take Cairns ashore, or else if the communists were coming on board, they used to go and fetch him. So we had to get rid of them, and we more or less told them that we needed some stores urgently, and of course they went ashore, and by that time we'd disfigured everything and prepared, gone into damage control stations. And then just as we were about to leave at 10 o'clock, Commander Cairns had ordered that the cable be greased up and also wrapped in blankets, so that when he rang on slow ahead, we came up slow ahead and the anchor was dead upright. So as soon as we'd done that, he knocked the pins out and the anchor went straight down. Well, as we'd done this, the around the corner up ahead of us was a steamer come down through with lights and that on. And, of course, he waited until this got abreast of us. And as it got abreast of us, he steamed up and came round the side of it. And just as we got abreast of it and started to pass it, the communists noticed that we'd gone then. We'd slipped anchor. And they started opening fire. And it was that particular time that they hit the steamer. And they got the casualties. And we I think we had just one shell in a store compartment, which didn't do much damage anyway. So we're able to steam away. Can I just... As I said, the ship was hit once during the breakout in the naval store. The store was flooded, but the loss of what stores was left at that time was not a major disaster. The shell hole was plugged. At that particular time, we managed to kept steaming, although we were shelled pretty frequently at that particular time within their range, and but I think the upper deck people can give a more vivid account of what happened in that respect, because Ian and myself were down on watch in the engine room at that time, so we didn't have a clue what was happening up top. Only, you know, from the time we left, because we were concentrating once Commander Cairns had rang full steam ahead, then our particular importance was to make sure that the machinery was running perfectly, you know, with no snags. Because if we'd have had a breakdown at that particular time, you know, we would have been really in the soup.
And did it?
It did rang perfectly with no problem at all. We had no problems at all. And we anticipate that we might have had trouble, you know, with not having run the machinery for quite a while, only every third day, and especially not the main turbines, because we hadn't flushed the main turbines for quite a while. But luckily, everything ran perfectly.
Was it just good luck, or was it good
management? No, I think it was good management, because we'd been rained, and it occupied our time during the time we were in captivity up there to keep the glands and different parts of the machinery well oiled and packed, so that we were, when it came to the breakout, everything was in tip-top condition. In fact, at the end of the a report which came out once we reached Hong Kong, and that from because it said from the report that the list of defects finally rendered to the chief engineer at Hong Kong the minimum required to make the ship seaworthy for the passage to the UK contained 21 items, including defects caused by action damage, and this was recommended with the ship's 3 months overdue for annual refit, is sufficient testimony to the good work put in by the survivors of the engine room department, which was recorded to us once we reached Hong Kong, you know, which was satisfying to the engine room department that we'd, you know, done a good job. And we were actually praised by the CMC when he came on board to think that we'd kept this machinery up to scratch, and that which helped in was a major thing in helping in the breakout.
How tense was it in the engine room during the breakout?
Naturally, I think was tense, because if a shell did come through the boiler room or through the engine room and put pay to the machinery, you know, we would have just been sunk there and then with no problem, because once the engines broke down, I mean, they would have had patrol ships out and just captured us. And I'm pretty certain that, you know, none of us would have got out then. Not even, you know, because I don't know whether, I think Commander Cairns said that he'd only get out by negotiations, but I think it was only obvious that they would have destroyed us, because having given us fuel, and within a few days of giving us fuel, we escaped with it, you know. Would have been a big factor in their destroying us, naturally.
What was the first inkling that you had in the engine room that the escape had been successful?
Well, there was one other big obstacle which Commander Cairns kept me informed in the bridge. We had a barrier, which was, I don't know what position it actually was in the, I can't remember now, but they had a barrier across the Yangtze, and you had to pass through the centre of this barrier, and there was two lights that you could either take the right of the light or the left of the light. And when you think that Commander Cairns at this particular stage was doing full power and steaming at night, which you don't naturally steam at night on the Yangtze, and he had to decide which side to take, left or right, or port or starboard. And what particular side he took, I don't know now, but he took the right side. If he took the other side, then we would have been just crashed into a barrier. As it was, once we got through that barrier, I think it's recorded that there was a junk, or quite a big-sized junk, which got in our path, and we crashed through it. And the next news I heard of when Commander Cairns sent a signal, sent a message down to me in the engine room, to say that 100 was up, 100 miles was up, and we were going well. So, at, and then, of course, the next thing is he said Wusung in sight. He sent a signal down to me to say that Wusung was in sight, which was the entrance to the Yangtze. And the next one was to say that Concord was in sight, which Concord was steaming to meet us. So I sent, I can always remember his name there, Stoker Winfield, up to the upper deck, to because everybody was still at action stations that time. And he came then to report that we were out in the open sea and Concord was just about to catch us, which was good. And then, of course, I sent two or three more up then. And, you know, they Concord passed us. And Commander Cairns said... we're eight, and then he said at that particular time he sent that, you know, the famous signal that he sent, which is to say that have rejoined the fleet south of Wusung, you know, which was marvellous. And then, of course, the next worry was whether we would just have enough fuel. And I went round and checked the tanks and found that we had, in my estimation, round about 7 to 9 tons left. And Commander Cairns said, "Well, don't worry, Chief." He said, "We're going to some island off Wusung," and he said they're going to fuel us, and they put fuel into us, and then we steamed back to Hong Kong. Then,
what reception did you get there?
Oh, marvellous, marvellous reception. Oh, well, it was marvellous. Although we had one worrying time, because on the way to from Wusung to Hong Kong, I think it was the Jamaica that came and met us with the CNC and everybody on board, and a lot of the Amethyst crew that had been evacuated from the ship, they were on the Jamaica. Well, it was about 12 o'clock at night. I'd just come off the first watch, which was from 8 to 12. And I was just going into our mess to turn in, and Ian had taken over the middle watch. And we suddenly started to black out. And we had a fan, a four-straft fan in the boiler room, where the connecting rod had parted. The bolt had come out. So Commander Cairns sent for me and said, "Can you fix it?" So I said, "Yes, I think we can fix it." He said, "Well, do your best, Chief," he said, "because I don't want anybody else from the Jamaica to come onto the Amethyst at this stage." He said, "We've come all the way down that river," he said, "and we've come out. Luckily it broke when we were out of the river." And he said, "I don't want anybody to come on board," he said, "because the captain of the Jamaica has signalled to say that he's got a working party which will come on board and help repair the damage." And he said, "If you can repair it, then let me know." So he sent a signal back to say that he think he could manage, and we repaired it within the hour and connected it up, and we steamed away, fortunately.
Why do you think he didn't want anybody on board?
Well, I think he thought that, well, he'd been up the Yangtze all that time with that particular crew on board and maintained it all, and he thought, well, no, I don't want anybody else on board, you know, because they would have sent a working party from... Not our original crew, but from the Jamaica interim staff. And he didn't want anybody else on board. He thought, well, you know, you've done all the glory up there, then you should take the acclaim for it, if you could fix it.
So he could say it was done entirely by the crew.
By the crew.
Can you describe the reception you got?
Well, it was marvellous because we were naturally, you know, we were short of the engine room staff, as I've said before. And of course, all of them more or less had to be on watch down in the engine room. And of course, we had to send each other up at stages to see the welcome, because they had the typical Chinese welcome where they had the junks, you know, with the fountains going up, and I think there was two or three American ships in there, and we, I mean, let's face it, we didn't realise what fuss we'd caused, you know, worldwide, and I mean, it did cause it worldwide, because we had calls to visit Australia and Canada and America all on the way home, and goodness knows what, you know, and Karen's just wanted to take the shortest route, and we called it Singapore, I think, and Port Said and Malta and Jib and all that on the way home, you know, and had terrific welcome. But I mean, going back to Hong Kong, when we landed at Hong Kong, the engine room staff at Hong Kong had organised a ship similar to ours. I think it could have been the Black Swan crew. They came en bloc. The first people they allowed on board was the engine room crew and boiler room crew of these two of this ship, and they actually came down with an engineer officer, and they came down, and we didn't expect them. They came down and they said, "Chief, out," and we all had to go out, and the boiler room staff. And he said, "We want you." He said, "The captain wants you to go straight into your cabin, change into your tropical rig, which you all in Hong Kong you all wore white." He said, "Because the CNC, Admiral of the Fleet, and everything wants to address you." So they waited until we changed in the boiler room and engine room, and those particular crew took over the shutting down of the engine rooms and everything. We just had to leave everything, and we went up, changed, and came up. And as soon as we reported to Cairns that we were up and changed. Then the commander in chief called us all together on the quarter deck, and gave a nice speech and welcomed us back to the fleet and everything, which was nice.
What about the reception in Singapore?
Oh, marvellous! All the way home, you know, right through the Suez Canal, because we had British troops and all out there in the Suez Canal then, and every part you pass, you know, the troops and all that were lined up, and wonderful reception. I mean, we even had a wonderful telegram from Monica Skinner, who was the captain who was killed on the Amethyst. And in fact, we still keep in touch with her. She lives at Gosport, and we go over and have lunch with her quite often, and she's a wonderful person. And we even had a lovely telegram from her welcoming us home from the Yangtze. So it was nice.
What was done for you once you got back to Britain?
Well, I mean, the most fantastic reception was at Plymouth, when we landed at Plymouth. I think the whole town must have turned out and it must have allayed into the Devonport dockyard, because the ship's side was lined. And they'd done exactly the same thing again. They got the another crew to come on board, and sent us down, came down below, told us to go up top, dress and everything, so that the CNC of the home fleet could come on the quarter deck and welcome us again. You know, so that they waited until we'd changed, because naturally we were still down the engine room again, which was the same in both ports we called at, because. You know, it was marvellous.
Going back to the Amethyst incident itself, were you and your ship